is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 83. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I am a multiple award-nominated author, podcaster, and creative coach and consultant. I've been a DIY independent creator, author, and publisher since the late 1980s. I have over a dozen published works available anywhere books are sold online, or, it's worth mentioning, directly at mattselznick.com, where you can name your own price for the ebook editions of my books and short stories. Additionally, my day job is helping other creators bring their works to fruition, to market, and to an audience. And I've been doing that since the turn of the century. Every episode of Sonatotum, I'm either talking to you and sharing the triumphs and discoveries and challenges and mistakes that I make as I forge a creative writing life, or I'm talking to another creator, usually an author or writer of some kind. That's this episode's focus. This time around, I'm speaking to Jeffrey E. Doherty. Jeffrey is an Australian author of award-nominated children's fantasy stories. He's an illustrator, a speaker, a book reviewer, and a book cover designer. His books include Paper Magic, and his darkly humorous upper middle grade fantasy series, The Guardians of St. Giles. Jeffrey has created over a dozen book covers for IFWG Publishing and a number of covers for SQ Magazine, including the May 2014 edition, which won the Australian Shadow Award. Jeffrey has worked as a nurse, a police officer, a learning support officer, and most recently, a librarian. He brings his experience from all those careers into his writing and his art. And no surprise, you can find him at jeffreyedoherty.com. And that's jeffreyedoherty.com. This is a good conversation. I think we had some fun. And I think you will enjoy, I think you'll like where Jeffrey's coming from. So let's get into it. Here is my conversation with Australian author Jeffrey E. Doherty. So the way I like to start these conversations is a very basic question. What do you create?
I create art, stories, and books, a bit of all three.
What media for the art?
I paint in mainly acrylics and watercolors because oils are just messy and a pain in the butt and they take ages to dry. Even though you can't blend as well with the acrylics, I kind of like the acrylics. And watercolors are great because you can stick them in your backpack and take them wherever you want. I just come back from holidays and I took my paints with me on the holidays and painted nearly every day while we're out.
Well, and tell us a little bit more about stories and books, because that could cover a lot of ground.
Yeah, well, I started off writing stories like when I was a teenager, and most of them weren't very good because I wasn't a big reader back in the day when I was a kid, and I wasn't really good at it. But I had a really good teacher in year 11 that actually inspired me to start reading. And strangely enough, after that, my stories got a bit better because I knew what I was doing. I mostly write for children, sort of middle grade to young adult age group. So that's because my brain still thinks I'm 12, but that's all right. And the books, same thing. I write middle grade and young adult for kids.
So you've told us about what you create. Why do you create?
There's a couple of reasons why I create. Like the books that I'm writing at the moment, I worked for 12 years in a school working with kids that have a disability. Some of them were physical disabilities, some were like learning disabilities. And they had no heroes in literature that they could really relate to. There was no one that looked like them, no one that acted like them. And so basically all my characters and my main characters in my books are broken in some way, basically to give them like heroes that they can relate to. So that's one of the reasons that I create. The other one is to stay a little bit sane when I'm creating stuff, but I'm actually doing okay. When I stop creating, I know that I've got issues and I need to sort of fix it up a bit.
That's something that's come up a few times in the conversations that I've had in the last couple of weeks with folks. The idea, and what you've said is sort of the inverse of this, but I wonder if it's similar. The idea that when we're not creating, and I can speak for myself as well, there's some level of depression or anxiety or general malaise that sets in. You know, for me, I tend to become irritable and short-tempered. And if it goes on too long without the opportunity to make something, you know, even if it's not writing in particular, then it can evolve into the more sort of classic symptoms of depression, the lack of vitality and the lack of motivation and self-doubt and all those things. Is it that way for you, or is it more, as you said, where if you're not creating, that's sort of a signal that something is wrong, not that maybe not creating causes the effect?
It's sort of like a chicken and egg thing. I don't know. I worked for a long time as a police officer and left there with post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And for like 3 years, I didn't create anything. And when I finally started to get on top of that, I started doing things that I liked again. So I don't know whether it's caused by that or whether being depressed and anxious stops you from creating or whether stopping creating causes it. Personally, I think it's more that when I'm feeling that way, it stops me from creating. It's not as a result of not creating.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not correct, but I draw an immediate line between your experience with PTSD and working with kids with disabilities and focusing on protagonists who have disabilities or are otherwise abled, as they say. Did the work with kids with disabilities begin after your career as a police officer? And was that part of your healing?
I think it was, yeah. It was basically an accident. I've come out of the police service and I spent like 3 years sitting at home doing nothing. I just couldn't sort of do things. And when I started to get a little bit better, I needed to get out. And there was a job going at a crossing guard down at the in front of the local school. And I did that for a little bit. And then I was talking to one of the teachers and who said that they were looking for some particularly male teachers' aides for some of the kids that were having some issues. And I took a resume in and started a couple of weeks later and didn't look back. I was there for 12 years.
Wow.
I think it sort of helped me to heal as well. And yeah, and just sort of working with the kids and like they're such amazing kids and just thinking I need to sort of give them sort of something, give back sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just live up to their example, but provide them with an example as well. And well, just to put it simply, representation, right?
Yeah. Well, the character in my first book, Paper Magic, she has spina bifida and she's in a wheelchair, but that's not her disability. Her disability that she had anxiety issues and that was causing her all sorts of problems. So the fact that she was in a wheelchair was just incidental to the story. It was all more about her anxiety and stuff. So it's not just, oh, I'm going to put a disabled character in the story.
And I love that the actual thing to overcome in that case, I mean, let's face it, just like most well-rounded fictional characters, that the actual thing to overcome is usually an internal struggle, an internal thing, right? Yep. The plot is often driven by the thing that the character has to, well, fix, for to put it crudely, you know, or at least realize.
Yeah. And they, like they say, write what you know, and I've been through that sort of struggle as myself.
Right. So
that,
well, there you go.
Yeah, that was a fairly cathartic thing as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned, though, I recall that coming around, you said it was grade 11 that you had a teacher that inspired you to become more of a reader. Is that when you started writing, you know, dabbling in fiction storytelling?
Oh, no, no, I was writing really, really bad fiction well before that.
Sure. Well, who wasn't?
But right? I had no idea what I was doing. I've discovered in year 11 that when you're doing a book report, don't mention the actors' names, because that sort of gives it away that you didn't actually read the book, you only watched the book. And I had this discussion with the teacher saying, like, Wuthering Heights, I'm 15 years old. Who would read Wuthering Heights at 15 years old? This is horrible. And my teacher said, well, come down to the library with me. We'll find a book. I'll read it as well, and I'll mark you on that. And he actually went through, and I bust around for a while, and he found Fahrenheit 451. And he said, read this one, you'll like it. And I did. And then I thought that was all right. And then I sort of got into like The Hobbit and Tolkien and lots of fantasy stuff growing up. And yeah, it was just from there, I just read everything I could get my hands on. Now I've got to keep buying bookshelves in my library.
Right. And the stuff that you write, now I've read Paper Magic. I remember that one. Do they all have a bit of the fantastic in them? Is that the focus? Do you cross genres, or is it primarily? Yeah.
Paper Magic was a really nice story, and it was lovely and uplifting. And my next, my book series is basically dark fantasy, nearly crossing over into horror for kids.
Mm-hmm.
I had a review on Amazon that this is like Stephen King for kids.
Fantastic.
Well, I prefer him, they would have said Neil Gaiman, but that's okay. I'll take Stephen King.
Yeah, you know, you could do worse.
Yeah, lots of magical elements in my stories. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you live in the real world and you have enough of that. So you've got to have something to, like an escape to get away.
Right.
And I think a lot of it was my grounding in, like, my first books that I read were fantasy books and science fiction books, and that I still love those today. So that helps.
Sure, absolutely. And with the fantasy stuff, how, and this is a selfish question because this is something that I'm constantly battling, what I half seriously call procrastination, right? You're doing writerly adjacent things because it all is sort of kind of for the book that you should be writing, but it's not actually writing the book. How deeply do you go into world building, character development, all those sort of secondary and tertiary things that we could blanket with the world building moniker?
I cheated a little bit with my series because I did a bunch of short stories based in a made up city.
Mm-hmm.
All the stories were set in the city, and I did a lot of world building for that. So I basically just moved my book there.
There you go.
I've sort of come across a formula for my writing at the moment where I don't plot everything out and I don't pants it. I call it signposting.
Mm.
As long as I know how it starts and how it ends and the major things that happen in the story, I sort of start the story and just give the characters a shove towards that first goal. Mm-hmm. And then follow them around and write down what they do. And then when they get there, they head to the next goal. And it sort of keeps me from going way off into left field. And but I don't stifle myself and say, well, I can't write that because it's not in the plan.
All right. Yeah. As long as it's sort of on the path, more or less.
Yeah. It's sort of good. I've got enough little, like, markers to get there. And so I don't have to plan everything out. And I know my characters pretty well now because I'm up to the fourth book in the series. And so I know how they react. And I know I'm ready to write the next book when they're having conversations in my head. And I'm I got to start writing these down.
And this isn't too far off from the way I work with larger works in a lot of ways. Your signposting idea, I think of them as tent poles.
That sounds good too. Yeah.
Yeah. Same idea. You know, you know that there's certain things that, you know, either are signposts along the way to the end or hold up the whole structure. Now, I admit, especially on novel length works, I go pretty deep. I tend to outline all the way down to the scene level, to the beat level, which just works for me because a lot of the writing is in that sort of kind of outline phase. The problems are solved then. And the when I actually sit down to start writing, number one, I know exactly what has to happen that day, what I have to write that day, because, you know, I've got 70 odd beats worked out. And it keeps me kind of on task, but also I don't worry too much about. I've already kind of let people meander in that outline phase. You know, I've let the characters go astray. I just haven't written thousands of words while they're doing it. You know, but yeah, you mentioned, you know, knowing the start, knowing the end, exactly, myself as well. Sometimes an idea will start with the end. I know the last scene.
Well, I can't start writing until I know how it ends.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but what I wanted... Go ahead.
It's been a long lead into this one, for the final book, because I wasn't 100% sure how it ended. So it wasn't until I got that clear in my head that I could actually start on the writing phase. Because every time, if I don't know how it ends, every time I've started a book, it's never finished.
Yes, preach, indeed. Yeah. And yeah, the my work in progress now, as we're talking to each other in late January of 2023, and honestly, we'll probably still be more work in progress when this gets to the air. I was stumped on that for many months because I just didn't, I kind of had the ending, but I didn't quite know why. You know, it didn't, it was just a scene. There wasn't anything behind it. I really had to figure out motivations and character stuff. But the thing I wanted to ask you about, so you talk about, you know, figuring this out for each book. Have you also, it sounds like, from what you just said, you also had that in mind for the four or five books in the entire series arc? Had you already worked it all out, kind of, sort of?
Yes, I knew what had to happen sort of over the whole course of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And that each book has sort of like a different sub theme.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first book in the series, Olivia Stone and the Trouble with Trixies, by working at the school, you realize that a lot of the really popular kids that are sort of sporty and attractive and popular weren't very nice people. They were like mean and a little bit nasty, and they picked on the other kids when the teachers weren't looking. And so I just wanted to twist things around in my first book. So my main character, Olivia, she has scars because was in an accident. And the other main character is Yip, who's a gargoyle, and he's ugly. And the heroes in the book are scarred and ugly. And the Trixies look like 5-6-year-old sweet little angelic little children, but they're nasty and it's all a camouflage. So it's like that twisting the concept of ugliness and beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And the second book was basically overcoming fear. So yeah, it's just each one has a theme, but I knew where the arc had to go in each one. So her being reluctant in the first book and becoming more empowered in the second book and the third book. Yeah, so that was my whole thing with that. But I'd sort of like the whole overarching thing, I knew where it was going. So yeah.
And this is, on the subject of themes, this is something that, I mean, this is a big thing for me. I try to make sure that I'm saying something, you know, that the book is about something, not just what happens in the book, but, you know, there is a theme or a message. And I'll admit to being, you know, a little snobbish about this. You know, I think that it's one of the reasons, it's definitely one of the reasons that I do this is not necessarily to get on a soapbox, but to say something, you know. And theme, of course, is, you know, how we think about that. How often do you find that you might have your intended theme and then, you know, maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years after the book is out in the world, either a reader or you yourself go, oh, so this is what it's about. Maybe something completely different or in addition to what you had originally intended, you know, having a reader come to you with feedback on the book and you, it never would have occurred to you that it might move someone in the way that it moved them in particular. Have you had that experience? And, or as I said, something that you yourself just realized, oh, this is what I was actually writing about when I was trying to write about this other thing.
Well, yeah, sort of. Mm-hmm. Like writing and art are the same. It's a two-way street.
Yes.
You write what you want to write, but it's the reader's experiences and their whatever that interpret that, and they take it their own way.
Yeah.
And music's the same too. There's an artist I really like called Aurora. She's a Norwegian singer. And like people had discussions online about what her song's about. And it doesn't matter what her song's about. It's how the song makes you feel and what it does for you. So someone might think she's saying this and they're saying that, but it doesn't matter. It's what it means to the person that's listening or the person that's reading.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a valid point. Sometimes that what you're meaning to get across isn't what they take out of it, but what they take out of it might be more important than what you meant in the first place.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I've had that experience with my stuff. And what about the personal realization? Like I know, and especially with my first book, and more recently with a novelette that I finished relatively recently. Like with my first book, it was literally years. I was in the middle of a revision and I suddenly realized, oh, this whole thing is really just about daddy issues. This is this is not what I was thinking of when I was writing it, but it is clear as day. Have you found that going back on your own work and realizing, wow, I was really working through something here and I didn't even know it?
Well, I think a lot of it is because a lot of my writing is working through the things that I went through in the police. And so a lot of that darker side comes out, and then I've got to try to lighten it up a little bit.
With the kids,
I sort of leave the darky stuff in there, but you got to put enough comedy in there to counteract it. So My books are quite, they have lots of humorous stuff, but it's serious stories that are going on, but there's enough humor in there to line it up. And there's nothing, I don't put anything really overly graphic in there because it's writing for kids. But like, I remember growing up as a kid and on a Friday night, I used to sit up with mum and we'd watch the Friday night creature feature movie that was on.
Sure.
It was just that feeling of being terrified by this movie, but feeling safe because I was sitting there with my mum.
Yeah.
Was just wonderful. And I think kids like that feeling of being a little bit scared.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the best place for them to be scared is while reading a book because it's somewhere safe.
Completely under their control. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They can stop if they want to. And so that's why I leave the scary stuff in there. But like, there's got to be enough lightness in there to counteract that. So it's a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I wonder if the attraction for kids to the scary stuff, the thrillers, the more horrific, if that's not too strong a word, I wonder if that's part of just a natural inclination to push boundaries, to explore a little bit beyond, that just sort of naturally happens as you leave childhood and enter into adolescence, young adulthood. You may have thought about this much more than I have. Indeed, you probably have, because I'm just thinking of it now. But does that ring true? Does that sound right?
I think it does. I think it does. And that aim to sort of how far you can push things, and especially with boys, girls aren't quite as sort of, especially with like the scary stuff, they're not as, I don't think they push as hard, but I think a lot of it too is that kids, especially teenagers, think they're bulletproof too. That wouldn't happen to me. So that's why I think that's why they get into some silly situations. But I think there's a definite correlation there between their thirst, the adrenaline sort of things. I think that's why some of the like the action games that they have on the PlayStation that now are so popular, because it sort of they can do that without actually reading. So, and I think writers have to, they've got to try to overcome that when they're trying to attract kids to read their stuff. It's got to be a bit of action in there and a bit to get them hooked in. Otherwise, they're just going to play a PlayStation.
Yeah, I think about that. Questions of pacing. I try not to worry too much, perhaps to my detriment. I tend to cling to the idea that, okay, whatever I'm writing is the joke is that semi-seriously that I make things for people who like the kinds of things I make, you know? And so I try not to think about or worry about, is this right for the intended audience? But I do, that's crossed my mind recently is the shift in attention spans and I won't say lack of focus, but a change in how folks, especially kids perhaps, are focusing, you know, not that they're not focused.
It's even adults as well, because I think the attention span for an adult these days is about 7 minutes. So if you haven't caught them in 7 minutes, they're gone.
Right. I think this is why you'll see so many television shows that will start in media res and, you know, do the cliffhanger, and then, you know, there'll be a scene wipe and it says, you know, 12 hours earlier or whatever.
On saying that, I started watching a new series last night. It was a book series I read years ago called Lockwood & Co. And they've just come out as a Netflix series.
Yeah.
And it started off with the big action scene and she's just about a cliffhanger. Literally, she's hanging off holding onto a frame of a painting and about to fall down and die. And then it cuts away and goes 3 years earlier.
Right.
And then it leads back in and 10 minutes later you get back to the scene where she's hanging off the balcony. So I think that's a lot of it. They do the big action scene to start with and then click back. I try not to do that.
Same here. I fear it's becoming almost a cliche, almost a trope. But on the other hand, are we losing readers, losing potential audience because of it, because of the nice slow burn beginning? I don't know.
I don't know if it has to be like a full action scene, but it needs to be something that goes, oh, what's happening there?
There has to be conflict. Yeah. Well, yeah. Then, I mean, that's just fiction.
One of the writing workshops I did years ago was with the Australian writer Kate Forsyth, and she basically said you need to start the story where their life changes.
Mm-hmm.
So when they come from their normal existence into the thing that makes them go off on a tangent, and for the story to happen, that's where you need to start it. And so that's usually something that's quite intriguing or quite exciting. So it seems to work.
Yeah, the proverbial inciting incident. That's definitely true. Absolutely. You know, that's just Western storytelling. It's what we're sort of conditioned for. I do think, though, that we lose something if we leap right into the fire from paragraph one, page one, because we don't know enough to care about what happens to this person. You know, we don't know them yet. I'll get up on the hill and say that that's a cheap thrill, you know, to not at least spend a little time introducing the person before they're hanging from the painting. You know, figure out who the heck they are, why the heck they are, and what's wrong with them that they got into this position in the first place, you know, wrong in quotation marks, but it's a tricky balance. And
it gets easier in a series because you'd think that the people reading your third book and read the first two, so they would actually know the characters by then. So that helps a little bit.
Well, sure. That's for sure.
That first book is hard because, like I said, you need to make them care, but you need to keep them involved. Like with Paper Magic, my first book, it started off as a picture book that was like 3,000 words long, which was way too long. And then I turned it into a short story and sent it off to a competition and got shortlisted, which was really nice.
Hmm.
Then one of my writer friends said that, oh, that'd make a really good chapter book if you broke it down into chapters.
Right.
That's how that started. But I was at a writer's festival and they had a first page competition where you put your first page of your novel into the box, and they had a panel of editors and authors that they'd pull a page out, read it, and then give feedback. And they picked mine out and they read the first story. And there's an Australian crime writer called Gabrielle Lord, and they read the story and she got really cranky.
Oh, sorry. And
she basically said, I love the opening sentence. It just, this poor girl looking out the window at the park, watching the kids play and knowing that she couldn't go out there and play with them. And I just wanted to know why. And then the author started going on with all this rubbishy description crap, and it just made me great. And I'm sinking further and further down in my, like 200 people behind me going, ooh, I wonder who that was. And that was like a pivotal moment. I could have gone home and go, that's it, I'm not writing anything ever again. But I looked at it and I thought, ah, she's actually right. Everything she said was perfectly right. And I reworked it and I took a lot of the descriptive stuff out and I sprinkled it into the during the story, so it didn't actually detract from the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that that I picked up a publisher for it. So that was the bit that sort of woke me up and said, look, you need to do it better. And yeah, the funny thing was, about 5 years later, I was at another writer's festival and she was talking, and I went and spoke to her and I said, oh, I did a first page thing and you were one of the panelists. She goes, I hope I was nice to you. And I said, no, you were horrible.
But thank you.
And I said, but it was, everything you said was right. And I gave her a copy of the book and she was sort of really pleased. And
that's lovely.
She did a write up on her webpage about it, which was kind of cool.
That's great. Yeah, the scattering of exposition. I think we, especially with our first books, we may have an inclination to not trust the reader quite so much. Yeah. To not assume that the reader they're going to figure it out. They're going to pick it up. They're going to be patient. In fact, not front loading all of that exposition and all that information gives them a reason to keep reading. There's a continuous sort of push of, but wait, why is this like this? Well, I guess I'll keep reading to find out, you know? So let's segue a little bit into the second of the three sort of pillars of Sonatotum. We've talked a lot about making stuff. How do you define success for yourself as a writer, as an artist, as a creator? And where do you feel like you are on those terms, in those terms?
Well, making $1 million from my writing is not, it would be nice, but it's not one of my goals, because it's just completely ridiculous. If it happens, that would be amazing, but it's not one of my goals. I'd sort of have like steps in success. And my first thing is that I wanted to make art and stories that I'm proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a success.
Sure.
So that was my like first level of success, practicing my art and getting better at it and practicing my stories and getting stories that I think I'm really happy with. That's a big success in itself. My next one was to get published. And I've got nothing against self-publishing, but I wanted to get traditionally published. That was my goal. I thought if I do that, then I'm successful, because I wanted somebody else to say that you're good enough.
Right.
And so that was one of the things I was working towards. I had a couple of close sort of things where I had a book accepted and the editor that was fighting for it in the publishing company went on maternity leave and then went back to a different publishing company afterwards. And the new editor wasn't as sort of keen on it and it sort of got sent back. And I thought I could self-publish this, but I'm sort of glad that I didn't, because I reread it a few years later and thought this is really bad. So it ended up being a good thing. But yeah, that, so getting published was my second one. My third success is to make a difference. So like I said, working with the kids that I've been working with and doing something for them, like giving back. I mean, that's another area of success. So giving them someone to look up to. And I've had a lot of feedback from like the kids that have read the books, and they like finally they've got someone, they're just like me. I think that's another level of success that I'm still working towards and pushing towards all the time. And I think the main one, this is probably because I'm getting old, it's like leaving something behind.
Mm.
I can remember one of my grandfathers and one of my grandmothers, but I don't really remember my other ones. And I think it's probably being a little bit scared about being forgotten.
Yeah.
And no one will know who I was. But like art and books, you can read Alexandre Dumas, the Count of Monte Cristo from hundreds of years ago, and you can see into their mind.
Yes.
We put little bits of ourselves into all of our stories. And I think if someone reads my book in 100 years' time, if it's still around, finds it in a dusty attic somewhere, they'll go, oh, he would have been a cook. I don't know. That would be that. I think that's another level of success, that like a desperation success.
I want to touch back on number three in a bit, but number four resonates strongly with me. I'm going to be 56, and I have not been prolific, you know, especially when I look at the list of novels and other things that are sort of on the, you know, in the queue that have yet to be done. And you start to do the math, you know, it's like, well, if it's taking me this long to do that, and I have X number of things left that I want to do, and I'm going to need to be like,
your finger out.
Yeah, I'm going to need to live to 115, and all of those years are going to have to be with the peak of my capacities. And yeah. Do you have kids?
Yes, my kids are all grown up now. They're out in the world, and
okay.
I don't have grandkids. It's cool.
Yeah, so I don't have kids, and I wonder if that's part of my sort of mild obsession with legacy. So I definitely relate to all of that, especially, you know, my last parent died in the summer of 2019. And since then, you know, I don't know if your parents are still with us or not, but that definitely was like, ooh, yikes. And, you know, you start to go through their things and realize all the things that they wanted to do and all the artistic or otherwise aspirations that they had. And I mean, that's being human, right? That's everybody's story. But no, the idea of leaving something behind, as you said, that's, I wouldn't phrase that as a desperation thing, perhaps defensively, he says. but I think it's definitely valid. I give a lot of thought to what am I going to do with copyrights once I'm gone? Do we truly open up those story worlds and just let anyone play and have that be the legacy, you know? Or what?
You could be like Peter Pan. I think in England, they turned it into a national treasure and it's got copyright forever.
Ah, well, who owns that copyright? Who's controlling it, though?
No one, I don't know. It must be the estate.
The Barry estate. There's
like usually the 75 years and anyone can go and write a story, but they enacted it in Parliament over there, apparently.
Wow. But,
yeah, it's a national treasure and you can't go and willy-nilly go out and write a story about it. You have to get permission and make sure it's keeping to the belief system of the actual copyright holders.
The spirit of the, don't want people, to put it crudely, they don't want people shitting all over it. But flipping back to your third point about making a difference, giving back, tell me if you've got one or two favorite stories of reader feedback from a young person that has, as I like to say, provided you with a little soul coal to fuel the engine.
Yeah, it's not, there's sort of nothing big, just that kids have come up saying that, oh, that's so cool that character is like me, I can relate to them. They feel like they're an outsider. Mm-hmm. And I've never been able to relate sort of characters in books before because they're all like popular and in the in crowd and that's not me, but. And so it's good that I can relate to them because they're just like me. That's I'm waiting for that one to come up and say, I read your story and that did this for me. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, but even that is, you have to assume that for all of the ones who speak up in the way that you just mentioned, there are dozens or hundreds who feel the same way, but haven't had the opportunity to tell you, or just haven't, you know?
Yeah.
And that's so, yeah, no, you're doing.
I tried to find my high school teacher, not long ago. I sort of looked through, went to the school, and I didn't know where he was anymore. And just so I could say, you really made a difference. But, I'm not sure if he's even still alive, but I'm sort of disappointed that I didn't get to thank him.
I have the good fortune of having reconnected with my high school journalism teacher, who was everything you would want in a creative writing teacher, even through that lens, through the journalism lens. We are friends on Facebook, and she's still alive and well, and I'm grateful. In fact, let's give a shout out to Karen Wynn. I'm not grateful for social media about too many things, but I'm certainly grateful that I've had that opportunity to thank her for her part in that. But there was another teacher similar to you that I never forgot, but sort of missed the window, you know. They passed away before I was able to connect with them. And I think it's important. And just as we get so much gratification when we hear those kinds of things, you know, from folks that we've either directly or indirectly through our work, we're able to mentor and affect, you know, I know that for these folks, that's why they do it, right? They have the same goals. They want to make a difference. They want to be remembered by doing the work that we're doing.
Let's face it. They don't get paid enough.
Oh, that's for sure.
And they don't get enough, like, honors for what they do is amazing.
Yeah.
They work too hard. They don't get the thanks that they really deserve, and they certainly don't get the monetary. So they've got to be doing it for something.
Yeah.
And that's the least we can do, is say, thank you for inspiring me along the way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've kind of touched on this when we talked about why you create and the things that have driven you and brought you to this creative life. But talk a little bit more about maybe some of the, if you have them, specific habits, practices, lessons learned, that sort of thing, when it comes to staying physically and mentally healthy in the pursuit of building a writer life, whatever that means for you, whatever you want to share.
I try to eat healthy, and I'm not a gym junkie or anything, but I like to do a little bit of exercise, mainly walking, which is good. I used to swim a bit, but I threw my shoulder out, and that doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
But so I try to stay healthy that way. And like I said, I'm just creating things. If I'm feeling down, I'll go and start a painting. And challenging myself is good too. For some silly reason, I thought, wouldn't it be cool to paint a painting every day for 100 days? And so I said, I'm going to do that. They were like little 10x10 paintings. And there were days that I really, really didn't want to paint anything, but I did. And I made it all the way through to the 100 days. And it was like a challenge, but I could see the improvement in my paintings as the 100 days went on. Just before that, I was feeling a bit non-creative, and I wasn't doing much writing at the stage, and I wasn't doing much painting either. So I was getting into that downward slope again. So I thought, I've got to do something to pull myself out. And that really, really helped. And finding a job that you really, really like is good, because I've done jobs that I enjoyed working at the school, but it was fairly full on. And we moved interstate at the start of last year from New South Wales up into Queensland in Australia. Mm-hmm. And my plan was to have a term off and then do some casual work back in the schools. My wife had a look and said, there's a job going at the library, like a casual job at the library. And I put in for that. And now I'm surrounded by books every day. It's great. It's like they pay me to do this. It's wonderful.
What are you doing at the library?
Basically library services. So it's really good because there's all the different parts of the jobs in the library. Like, you've got the front end where you're standing at the front counter and greeting people and helping them find books, which is really good. And then you're doing shelving. And then we've got a big computer section. So a lot of people come in, they've got no idea how to use a computer.
Right.
So we do tech support. And then there's all the back end stuff, like books that are missing and trying to find them, and books that people have put on reservation that have come back in, and then getting them to the right place. And
reshelving.
We have 6 libraries in our council area, and you can borrow books from any of the libraries and take them back to any of the libraries. So we have couriers that drive them all around, and then we get
right.
It's really good. They like you'll do an hour or two in each bit during the day, and the day goes really quick, and you get to do a bit of everything. And it's wonderful. But I get sidetracked. I'm shelving, and I'm sort of sitting there. I've realized I've just read the blurb on the back of 3 books, going, "Oh, I'll have to bother those later on." I don't have to rush to get all that stuff done before.
Believe me, I worked in retail bookselling for well over a decade, and yeah, I get that. Yeah, you.
I can take them home for free.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I have a library card. But I think doing something that you really enjoy helps keep you healthy too.
Yeah.
And I think that's helped a lot. And like having a wife that's really supportive, that's probably the biggest thing of all. Like she stuck with me when I was going through all my issues before.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably wasn't the easiest person to live with back then, but so I appreciate that a lot.
She played the long game.
Yeah, she looks after me. She's a good girl.
Speaking of that challenge that you made for yourself with the 100 paintings, 100 days, what about from book to book? It's a well-known saying, and I think it's absolutely true, that every book is like your first book in some way. Do you intentionally set out to challenge yourself with each progressive book?
I think so. The challenge is to make the next one better.
Well, sure.
Like Paper Magic, the first one was like a long process, and like it went from a picture book to a story to a chapter book, and that was completely different to my other novels because I had the story. Then I was just expanding it and expanding it to without fluffing it out. I started doing National Novel Writers Month, NaNoWriMo, because I started about 6 or 7 different books and never got to the end of a book, and I thought, so I can't do this. I can do stories, I can't do books. And then someone said, I'll just do this, and it's a challenge to write 50,000 words. But I think the main challenge is to get the first draft down without worrying about whether the writing is good enough.
Yeah.
And that was a real eye-opener, because I had like my books that I had that are sitting in a drawer still, they've got like the first 15 or 20 chapters are super polished and wonderful, and then it just peters out because I got bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is now, get the story down, give yourself permission to write badly, and then go back and fix it. And like my first book in my series, I wrote it in 26 days.
Whew.
It was one of my NaNoWriMo books. That was when I worked out the signposts, and I knew basically where I was going. I wrote it down, got to the end and thought, oh, I've still got like 4 days left. I better write something else. So I just started doing some, I got to the 50,000 and I started doing some plans for the next book.
There you go.
And I thought, then it took quite a while to edit it. And then I thought, I know how to do this now. And I got to the second book and it took me 18 months.
Boy, does that sound familiar.
Yeah. And I'm going, this writing books is easy. 26 days, it's not a problem. And the second book was harder. The last book in the series, the fourth one that I'm doing at the moment, it had its own problems because there were a lot of loose ends to tie up,
right,
and a lot of linking it back into the earlier books as well. So it sort of come full circle because each book does that too. You start and you link back to the ending. It's got to link back to the beginning. And that was the problem with trying to work out how it ended in the final book. How it all links in and make sure all the loose ends are tied up.
Did you find that you needed to be a little more specific in your planning, or was that stuff that just sort of got filled in the editing phase? All of those loose end tying ups.
I think a lot of it's sort of in the editing phase.
Yeah.
There was a character in the second book that sort of disappeared and didn't make it into the third book either. And I thought, well, people are going to say whatever happened to him. And so I had to weave him a little bit of his story into the fourth book.
Yeah.
So people can say, oh, what happened to that character? He was like the main reason she was going out and doing this stuff in the second book, and then he was never mentioned again. So I thought, well, that that would be my reaction. So I thought, he has to make a reappearance.
So he's not just wandering on a blank page of limbo for all time. Yeah. So one of the ways that I've been closing these conversations is to ask the writer, the author, if you could distill the lessons that you've sort of accumulated over the course of your writing career so far down to a ridiculously pithy sentence or two, a bumper sticker that can sort of stand as your standard, your motto, your mantra. What would that be for you?
Try your hardest to make something worthwhile. Don't just do a story because it's a good idea. Make sure there's something in it. Like you're actually doing something that's worthwhile and something that you can be proud of.
That touches on what we were talking about before about, having some sort of meaning and intention behind all the fireworks and sword fights and magic battles and whatever else.
Well, you can have a really exciting story, but unless there's some substance there and it's, there's something like something more.
Mm-hmm.
It goes down to the core of why you're writing that story.
Yeah.
And making sure that that core stays in there. It's a fine line. You can't be too preachy about it. If some people don't get it, that's probably better than trying to over preach something.
For sure. Yeah. Because, if it's too on the nose or too much of a loudspeaker, a bullhorn, then for one thing, I think it narrows the opportunity that we were talking about before of people getting their own value, their own interpretation from something because you've blown their ears out, sort of metaphorically, you know.
With trust the reader too.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying is quietly and subtly make your point, but that and when that's done, you're leaving plenty of room for them to work it out and get what they want from it.
Yeah, especially writing for kids too, because I get a lot of people, like adults, that read and go, you can't use those words for kids. They're too big. And you go, no, they'll get it or they won't get it. Doesn't matter. If as long as it's in context, you can work out what they're saying.
That's right.
Can't talk down to them. Kids are cleverer than you think.
Absolutely. And they know when you're talking down to them.
Absolutely, yeah. So I write for myself. Mm-hmm. And that child that's in me, and that seems to work. It seems to be good because kids that really like the story, but their parents have read it and all that, and they like it as well. So there's enough there that the parents enjoy. If you've got a children's book that kids love but parents don't like, it's not really a good book because it's not round enough. It won't stand the test of time. But it's going to be something that is sort of universal that everybody can get a little bit out of.
Yeah, I think as adults, we all have books that we have been rereading since we were children.
Yeah.
As you said, it literally stands the test of time. You know,
I don't know though, because I didn't read a lot of books as a child. But maybe I'm wrong now. But books like The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman, I read that and cried because I thought, I'm never going to be this good. But that's inspired me to go that I want to be that good, and I'm going to keep trying to improve and to get that good.
That's one of the core aspirations that we can all aim toward. Is you're never going to be Neil Gaiman, but you're going to be you. I got some listener feedback that I played in the most recent episode. Well, as we're talking, at least the most recent episode, and the subject of genre came up, and the goal was sort of, let's aim to become our own genres. Like when people talk about a work, they say, "Oh yeah, it's really Doherty-esque."
Yes, that would be good,
right? I think that would be a worthy accomplishment.
That would be that's my next one on my success thing.
To add esque to your name, yes. Yeah. Well, Jeffrey Doherty, thank you so very much for the conversation, for taking the time, for dealing with what I can only imagine is a grueling time difference between where you are and where I am. And I think the listeners will get plenty of value and enjoyment out of our conversation. And I very much appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me along. That was good.
Well, there it is, my friends. I would love your thoughts and feedback on what you just heard, my conversation with Australian author Jeffrey E. Doherty. As always, you can go to the show notes for this episode, Sonatotum episode 83. Just visit mattselznick.com/sonatotum-083. Scroll down to the bottom and leave your comment there. Possibly even easier, you could send an email to matt@mattselznick.com. And I will, of course, reply to any emails that I receive. If you are so inclined, you could leave a little voice message, maybe record something on your phone and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. And I will play it in a future show and respond in the context of the show. And we'll have sort of a little time-shifted conversation in that way. I enjoyed Jeffrey's perspective on writing for children and his thoughts on legacy and the meaning behind what we do. These are all things that frequent listeners will know are near and dear to my heart, especially the legacy piece and the deeper meaning and the idea of challenging oneself. All good stuff, and I really enjoyed talking to Jeffrey. Hey, if you listen to podcasts of any kind, you probably know that ratings and reviews are super helpful for the popularity of the show and so the health of the show. Really helps to bring the show up in the search results when there's more ratings and reviews at places like Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. So if you could take just a few seconds to rate Sonatotum, you know, 5 stars is nice, but whatever you think the show deserves, if you could take a few minutes and write a review of this episode or any other episode of Sonatotum in your own words, I cannot overemphasize how helpful that is to help the show reach new listeners and to grow this community that we have. Speaking of community, I want to thank my multiversalist patrons, Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. Who are the multiversalists? Well, these are folks who have joined the community and pledged $5 a month and continue to pledge $5 a month to support the time and effort and resources that go into creating Sonatotum each and every week. You know, this episode alone is probably going to end up, I mean, I'm recording it right now, so we're not done, so I don't know, but it's probably going to end up taking somewhere between 10 and 12 hours to produce from the moment I press record on talking to Jeff Doherty to the moment that I press publish to get the episode out into the world. It takes a lot of time and effort. The multiversalists help offset the cost of producing the show. Chuck, Amy, JC, Ted, you can join them for just $5 a month when you go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron, or you can just click the menu item at the top of the screen there at mattselznick.com. Multiversalists, in addition to a bunch of other perks and privileges that you can read about there at that link, they get the uncut, unedited edition of every episode of Sonatotum. And that means, for example, in the case of this episode, that's going to be almost 45 minutes of additional content, including a bunch of stuff that I had to cut for time from my conversation with Jeffrey, including a pretty fun anecdote about George R.R. Martin and a fun little story about his work as a librarian. It's all there for the multiversalists and the multiversalists only. So if that's worth $5 a month for you, if what you get from Sonatotum is worth $5 a month, I hope you'll consider becoming a multiversalist over there at mattselznick.com/b-a-patron. Finally, if you haven't already subscribed to Sonatotum, I hope you will do that wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Subscribing for free, of course, means that you will automatically receive new episodes of the show just as soon as they come out. Try to get them out for you right around noon every Wednesday. Next episode will feature my thoughts fresh from attending the 2023 Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association Nebula Conference in Anaheim, California. It's May 9th, 2023, as I record this for you. I'll be leaving for the conference on May 11th. I'll be coming back on May 15th. So I will have plenty to say, I'm sure, about the conference. I have not been to a writing or genre-related convention or conference. Whew, it's been a long time, since 2009, I think. So I'm going into that environment with, I won't say low expectations, but I'm trying to have, as I try to do with all this kind of stuff, trying to have a beginner's mind about it and see things with fresh eyes and have open ears and an open heart. And I'm looking forward to reporting back. So that's next episode, Sonatotum 84. I'll be talking about my experience at the Nebula Conference. And if you don't want to miss that, the easiest way to make sure you don't miss it is to subscribe to Sonatotum wherever and however you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, whatever. Just make sure you subscribe. And of course, there will be links to all those things in the show notes for this episode, Sonatotum 83. Over there at mattselznick.com/sonatotum-083. It's not really rocket science. I try to keep it pretty simple. All right, my friends. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.